Welcome to our study today, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, December the 10th, 2010. Today we're going to open up our scriptures again, and we're going to seek to learn even more about the wisdom of our Father, His love, and His great provisions. We are on a path of learning to choose the good and refuse the evil. And this path of development and growth is oftentimes extracted and highlighted to us from the Holy Writ. But it's not the only way that you can communicate messages of righteousness. Sometimes the problems that envelop right within your midst are sources and focuses of study. You need to peer into the realities that exist and try to uncover, rather than react, try to uncover the basis, reason from cause to effect. Dismiss yourself from ego and from personal pride and see if you can uncover the negative or the positive reason. I put emphasis on positive because a lot of times there are positive lessons that we fail to garner because we are not introspective. The illustration occurred within the past couple weeks that makes the point. Now, there has been some trouble, and I call it trouble because is perceived as such, but I consider it to be growth amongst us and growing pains, whereby we have become anxious one with another. We need to open up that anxiety and to air it out and to see exactly what the lesson for us is today and how is it that the Lord is communicating to us. I'm not privy to the specifics, you understand? When a dispute arises, I don't always know the specifics. The Lord makes sure that I get enough detail so that I can forge an opinion, and I let Him address to me what the problem is. So let's speak hypothetically about the scenario, realizing that I don't have all the facts. But the scenario that I present is that from which the lesson today is going to be drawn. And if it's not applicable perfectly to the dispute, then we've still learned the lesson, right? Brother teacher gives a study. Then the next week, he spends that weekend in Disneyland or Disney World. He's unavailable to participate in the study. He takes his family down there, and we presume that he has a good time. But the next session, as he's representing the Sabbath study, a sister inquires. The value of women amongst us is very important because women sometimes will bring a question to the floor that men, following the strict rules of protocol, leave unsaid. The sister inquired, while you were in Disneyland, did you honor the Sabbath? A good question. A good question. Then, as it was communicated to me, the brother takes offense at that inquiry and replies, none of your business. Now, I know that I don't have all the facts, but that snippet of the dispute that may have left hurt feelings is enough for me to engender a lesson in righteousness that I can benefit from. This simple scenario provides a rich doctrinal bit to spread the mustard seed kingdom's growth. Understand, trouble besets us all. It's given to us for our growth. Let's revisit that scenario in the middle of our study after we turn to Luke chapter 16. Let's read verse 19 through 31. There was a certain rich man which was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. And there was a certain beggar named Lazarus which was laid at his gate, full of sores, and desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. And it came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died and was buried. And in hell he lifted up his eyes, being in torments, and seeth Abraham afar off, and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me. Send a Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue. For I am tormented in this flame. But Abraham said, Son, remember that thou in thy lifetime receivest the good things, and likewise Lazarus evil things. But now he is comforted, and thou art tormented. And besides all this, between us and you, he includes Lazarus in his answer. He says, between us and you. So Lazarus is with me now. You want me to send Lazarus away to help you. But you don't realize that between us and you, there is a great gulf. A great gulf fixed. So that they which would pass from hence to you cannot. Neither can they pass to us that would come from thence. Then he said, I pray thee therefore, Father, that thou wouldst send him to my father's house. For I have five brethren, that he may testify unto them, lest they also come into this place of torment. And Abraham said unto him, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. And he said, nay, O Father Abraham, but if one went unto them from the dead, they will repent. And he said unto him, if they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rose from the dead. So we read this chapter, this proverb. There are some very essential points here that can help us. We see a distinction. We see that the tables are turned. Wealthy are given punishment, and the afflicted are given mercy. There is a huge gulf between the redeemed and the condemned that none can pass. What is shocking, the lesson that I suppose caused theologians of the past to skip over this chapter in their search for doctrines that were in greater harmony with their theology, a bombshell is dropped in this theology that if we trust in the testimony of Jesus, it simply needs to be addressed. It's more shocking than the gulf that exists. It's more shocking than the tables turned whereby those are exalted or abased and those that are abased or exalted. This doctrine is even more upsetting than those. The burden for both Abraham and the rich man, as we lead up to that concept, their burden is the salvation for the living. Remember, the rich man asked for Lazarus to come and give him relief, and the answer was no. Then the rich man said, well, send Lazarus to my people's house. Evidently, the people's house that he was concerned with were not in the same place that he was. The issue of discharging Lazarus to his father's house, the house of his people, was not that there was a great gulf. It's just there was a question of theology, a question of the stubbornness of the human heart. Abraham was concerned as well. He didn't show concern for the rich man in his torment. He simply told him that you had good things in your days. Now accept the bad things. That was Abraham's judgment. But when it came to his family, he had a different answer. He said, they have Moses and the prophets. I'm excited about giving them an escape from your torment. I want to see them find redemption and salvation. I'm not that cold-hearted. Let's vest our hope in them based upon their reaction to Moses and the prophets. And somehow or another, the rich man showed why he's being tormented. Because he didn't trust in Moses and the prophets. He wanted them to receive a spectacular display of power and grace from heaven. He wanted someone to rise up from the dead. Abraham said, that's a flawed strategy. That won't work. But I mentioned the jolt to our theology that somebody needs to explain. Now is not the time to ignore the statements that the Lord relayed to us. We've got to account for them. Our salvation comes in the testimony of Jesus, and every word has to be revisited. So how do we account for the fact that the prayers and the salvation and the victory of the saints is offered not to God? You ever thought about this? Not to Jesus, not to Christ. That man's destiny, his eternal affliction, if we could call it that, speaking proverbially. And Lazarus, and I say proverbially, because I can't envision Lazarus, no matter how poor he was, finding eternal comfort resting in Abraham's bosom. We know that this is a figurative testimony. So the destiny, because the rich man wanted to be where Lazarus was. He wanted to be in Abraham's bosom. And now, he says, how many brethren do I have? Five. So now the issue is over his five brethren. Father Abraham, how can I bring salvation to them so that they too can rest in your bosom and find comfort and peace? Don't you feel challenged by that question? Maybe we should table it for another season. Continue to ignore it. But at least you have to understand the challenge of it. All this time, we've been walking around teaching that our salvation is vested in God. And we'll quote John 3:16. But nobody told you that John 3:16, as valuable as that text is. And the mustard seed advent finds great joy in that text. It's no different than this. The only difference is that your ministers haven't drummed this into your head. You can't turn on the Super Bowl game and see somebody holding a sign, Luke 16:20-31. But they both have divine authorization and validation. So the question that I'm concerned with, and somehow or another this envelops around human disputes. The question I'm concerned with is, how is it that the prayers that Father instructed Christ to relay to us, that the prayers of the tormented and the salvation of those that are in this present generation is vested in their relationship with quote-unquote Father Abraham? So let's see if we can answer that question, so that we can discern what Abraham's place is amongst redemption. Let's turn to Genesis. Genesis chapter 18, and we're going to begin reading verse 16. And men rose up from thence and looked towards Sodom. And Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do? A little bit of background. The Lord was planning on bringing some affliction to some wealthy folks. He was planning on tormenting the folks of Sodom because of their sins. And yet he wanted to first, before he did so, consult with Abraham. How curious. I know the Bible said that Abraham was his friend. But this is a new concept, isn't it? Abraham's involvement in the judgment. Why is Abraham involved? Why does the Lord want to discourse with Abraham before he executes judgment? Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. When you see Lazarus resting in the bosom of Abraham, it's referring to the blessing that the redeemed are going to receive through the children of Abraham. He's going to become a great mighty nation, but he's not going to become every nation, because all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. There is no eternal blessing if it's not vested in Abraham's house. In the final analysis, this is what the Lord was trying to show you. You need to garner access to Abraham's house. He's the one that I'm going to convey life and death decisions. He's the one that's going to dole out responsibilities for punishment. The Lord continues in verse 19. For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him. Christ's knowledge of Abraham was not that he commands his children and his household after God. Not that he commands his children and household after Jesus. He commands his children and his household after himself. So we have a clue now. Maybe I should continue to read the phrase before we tap into the clue. Hopefully I don't forget it. For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord, to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. We see now that the blessing of Abraham is not communicated through the man himself. The blessing is communicated to the nations through his children. Therefore, when the Lord parabolically refers to Abraham, he's giving the commanders of the house a singular identity. They deserve a singular identity because they manifest the faith of Abraham. See, let's keep our fingers there and let's race forward to a text that we've been studying. I just want to revisit it quickly. Isaiah chapter 51. From time to time, I will openly bring forth, as you're searching for the scripture, problems that exist amongst us. And I'll do so in open public air, the way the Lord did, you see. And then that way, that gives allowance for us all to benefit from the lesson. We're in Isaiah chapter 51, verse 1. The command is, hearken unto me, ye that follow after righteousness. Ye that seek the Lord, look unto the rock which ye are hewn, and the hole of the pit which ye are digged. Look unto Abraham, your father, and unto Sarah that bare you. For I called him alone, and blessed him, and increased him. But this message is not to Abraham, this is to Abraham's children. They're already following after righteousness, but as we studied about and unfolded in prior studies, they have some simple steps of advancement to take before they can become emissaries of the Lord. And as a result of that, the Lord awakens his arm. Verse 9, they are given an appeal to continue to hearken unto the Lord. He advances it step by step till he gets to the point whereby his arm is to awaken. Now, his arm signifies, because he points back to the Exodus movement, his arm signifies his deployment of his servant to assist him in the execution of judgment. Now, I don't know how you are, but that phraseology shrills up and down my spine even now, because I was trained from my youth to be fearful of the Lord's judgments. But as we've noted before, the righteous need not fear from his judgments. Not everybody that goes before a judge gets a negative verdict. She says, awake, awake, put on thy strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the ancient days, in the generations of old. Art thou not it that hath cut Rahab and wounded the dragon? Art thou not it which hath dried the sea, the waters of the great deep, and hath made the depths of the sea a way for the ransom to pass over? That arm, that miraculous manifestation of power, brought liberation to Israel. And this points to a day of liberation for God's people. It points us to the day whereby the arm is going to awaken so that they can be redeemed. I don't want to spend too much time here in Isaiah, but we must turn now to the end of that chapter. Verse 22. Thus saith thy Lord the Lord, and thy God that pleadeth the cause of his people. Behold, I have taken out of thine hand the cup of trembling, even the dregs of the cup of my fury, and thou shalt no more drink it again. He's talking to his people. These are people that have been afflicted, that have been impoverished, and that have been oppressed. These people represent Lazarus. And the Lord says, that today is going to be the day where you're going to receive your liberation. But I will put it into the hand of them that afflict thee. That points us back to Luke 16 in a neat way, doesn't it? Which have said to thy soul, bow down, that we may go over. And thou hast laid thy body as the ground, and as the street to them that went over. This is the day when the tables are turned. This is the time we're making reference to in our study from Luke chapter 16. And we see that the people that are going to participate in this work, not just based on what we read on Isaiah 51, but in a multitude and myriad of other texts that we have gone to, we see the revelation of the victory that the Lord is going to deliver to the world. Although now we approach it from a different dimension, don't we? We see the urgency of this awakening, and we see the urgency of Lazarus' redemption. And we see that from our text in Genesis 18. This may not have been a great point of focus in our prior studies, but there's no reason why we can't zero in on it now. It says in verse 19, for I know him, that he will command his children, speaking of Abraham, and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord, to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. And I really could have and should have included verse 18 in that rereading. He says, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. Therefore, if this awakening doesn't occur, if the righteous are not drawn towards Abraham so that the covenant that was made to him becomes the focus of their study. This is what Jacob typology is all about. Because this is the blessing that Jacob wanted. So in the antitype, this is what we are struggling for. And if we don't receive it, then the nations are not going to be blessed. We simply have to come to the conclusion that there are some judgments that can be painful. The Lord can hand down verdicts that are going to be upsetting, as we saw in Luke 16 with the rich man. But if the Lord hands down the verdict, and Abraham rules and trains his children so that they rule in justice and judgment, then his verdict is going to be justice. So let's be positive, because what this really means is that it's not God, but his disciples that are going to be the sources of the suffering and the joy distribution. Need be reached back into popular mythology, American custom. It was Santa Claus, right, that brought the gifts and the coal. Well, if we could use that simplistic example, it's the house of Abraham. Those who have learned to do justice and judgment that are going to be the ones that the people of the world and the judgment of the living are going to be held accountable to. In a way, we always knew this from those of us who have had a long history of Adventist theology, because we correctly understood that when we journey to heaven and abide there during the millennium, that we're going to judge, right, the wicked. We just have a clearer concept now of who those people are and the genealogy of their heritage. So Jacob sought this blessing, and it was given to him. And it was passed down through his son Judah. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. So Shiloh's got to be a son of Abraham, because the people gather for their blessing. There's no need for us to be upset or disturbed about this Bible theology. It's a good ending to a long, hard story. Multitudes are going to come, and they're going to find joy in the house of Abraham. Then a promise was made to David. David was promised, as many of our studies in the past have clearly shown, that his son, in a time way off, would be raised up, and that his son would be the one that would be given the scepter in the kingdom. Let's read that in Psalms chapter 110. Psalms 89, we're told that the Lord promised to raise up David's seed after him and to make him ruler over all generations. Therefore, it's no wonder that when the Lord began to recollect the summary of that event in Luke 16, that he showed people that would, and they're standing in the judgment, that were dead and that were alive. Because for the son of David, who is the son of Abraham, for him to preside over all generations would mean that he would have preeminence over the generations that have died and become resurrected, and the generations that are alive during the day of harvest. Which means that David's son is going to have preeminence even over David. His whole lineage, not just David, is going to come under his authority, including Abraham, including Noah, all the way back to Adam and Eve. Therefore, we now see the end from the beginning. And as we read in Psalms 110, verses 1 and 2, we're going to see it even clearer. The Lord said unto my Lord, let's take care to note each word. You have the Lord, and he's communicating to somebody else whom David referred to as my Lord. Sit thou at my right hand until I make thy enemies thy footstool. We know that hasn't happened yet, has it? Because the church even today, the righteous even today, are beset with enemies. The Lord says, be patient, be seated. Don't worry about picking up the staff and the rod right now and governing. Sit at my right hand until the day arrives when I make thine enemies my footstool. So whom is the Lord communicating to when he says that? The person whom David identified as his Lord. Having a conversation. Two different people. David's Lord is depicted in Luke 16 as Father Abraham. The one who you must appeal to gain entry into the eternal kingdom. He's the one that will distribute your blessings. Sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of thy strength out of Zion. Rule thou in the midst of thine enemies. This is exactly the day that was addressed and pointed to in Genesis 18. Because now, this son of Abraham, this son of David, is taken outside of Zion, and he's given a commission to rule right in the midst of his enemies. This release of David's Lord, this release of the Lord's servant, does not occur in heaven. It doesn't occur in Palestine. It occurs in the land of the Assyrian, as our book 5.0 shows, the land of the people that have sought to antagonize David and his household and the seed of Abraham. He emerges with the rod of strength. He emerges out of Zion. We're not going to spend any time today trying to decipher to you that Zion is a representation of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the Lord's last Gentile church, the church of Laodicea. And if you understand end-time events correctly, you'll see that that should not be a perplexity. Because the Lord does not favor them, he sends the seed of David, the son of Abraham, out therefrom so that they can rule in the midst of their enemies. And they do so with the rod. The rod message has been with us since 1930. It's a message of correction. It's a message that combines the work of E.G. White and V.T. Hotta so that we can know the Lord's corrective measures. But the rod is of no benefit without the shepherd. The shepherd goes forth under the authority of Christ, wielding the rod. And that's the formula for eternal peace and joy. So, the judgment comes by David's son, based entirely upon what we've learned from the testimony of Jesus. We have a concept here that has now been validated again for another time. How is it that he can rule in Christ's stead? That's usually a question that's posed and comes to mind to a lot of people. We've shown that he's a man after the Lord's own heart. So therefore, the Lord's judgments are his judgments because he embraces Christ's righteousness. From some of our emails, we've seen that the transference from our concepts of righteousness yesterday to the righteousness of Christ is a difficult journey. One that I'm sure that we're all glad that we've undertaken. One text of three that I'm going to cite to you gives you clearer insight into the Bible validation of this thesis. Isaiah 42, 1 and 2. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect in whom my soul delighted. I have put my spirit upon him, and he shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. But this is what you could expect in the day of judgment then. The Lord takes his elect. He upholds him. His soul delights in him. As you begin to grow, you begin to understand that your delights are not the Lord's delights. So when you witness this person, you may think, well, he rubs me the wrong way. You're having an experience that multitudes of people in the history of religion have had with Christ. He just rubs them the wrong way. And the reason why you feel rubbed the wrong way is because you thought you were going to slide into the kingdom by your own righteousness. And now when somebody zeroes in and identifies the fact that you need to make advances and improvements in your life, that person just rubs you the wrong way. Now, it could be possible that the Lord could find somebody that's more favorable to your sensibilities. That's possible, right? You say, well, that person, I like that person, they rub me the right way. Only problem is, though, is that there may be a multitude of other people whom the person that you favor brings to them great anxiety. So let's not be egotistical and self-centered in our concept. This is the day that we must grow. Second verse, Isaiah 55, verse 3 and 4. Incline your ear and come unto me. Hear, and your soul shall live. So this seems like it's contradicting the Lord. It seems as if he's asking people to come to him and hear. We only understand the seemingly contradictory statement, bringing resolution to it, through our knowledge of Deuteronomy 18, whereby the Lord promised that he would never speak to his people directly. That's why he says, incline your ear and come unto me. Hear, and your soul shall live. He's beckoning to you to honor the covenant that he made with Israel, whereby he put his words in his prophet's mouth, and then the prophet would communicate more peaceably to you. We know that Jesus was the prophet. No dispute about that. But the message that he delivered for our salvation was given to us in Proverbs. And the Lord in John 16 promises is going to be redirected to us, not proverbially, but plainly. So the servant that's elected to relay it plainly is delivering the same prophecy, the words that were put by Christ into Jesus' mouth. Incline your ear and come unto me here, and your soul shall live. And I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David. Behold, I have given him for a witness to the people, a leader and commander to the people. This is a message of everlasting life. Else it could not be said, hear and come unto me and your soul shall live. To do those things, you already have to be alive. The Lord is giving them everlasting life to match an everlasting covenant, to match an everlasting commander who is a man after his own heart. Behold, I have given him for a witness to the people, a leader and a commander to the people. Matthew chapter 20, verse 8. So when even was come, the Lord of the vineyard said unto his steward, unto whom?
Steward.
His steward. Call the laborers and give them their hire, beginning from the last unto the first. you've studied the parable, Matthew 20, you'll understand that the laborers are those that work in the Lord's church from the beginning of time. The steward is given what the Bible in that text shows, the penny. It's the formula for everlasting life, the reward for your labors. The Lord of the vineyard says unto his steward, call the laborers. I'm going to call the laborers, beginning from the last unto the first. Because some of the people that labored in your vineyard, Lord, have been long since gone. Call them forth. He's given the commission to call them forth. Those people that step forward from the grave, that have walked in righteousness. Let's think way back to Adam and Eve. But we know for surety Abel, because the Lord referred to him as righteous Abel. Come forth from the grave to receive everlasting comfort in the house of Abraham. That's his bosom. Then I see Cain coming forward to receive his punishment and his penalty at a later date when the resurrection of the unjust takes place. And there's no way of transport from one situation to the other. There's a great gulf fixed. But this is pointing to the day when the house of Abraham is established. Abraham said that the standard of the judgment of the living is going to be hearing Moses and the prophets. Something is quite curious with that, you see. Because the prophets themselves are dead. Thus, they should be in one of the other two places, right? They should be with the rich man or in the bosom of Father Abraham. The prophecies refer to the accumulation of light and truth as manifested in the Adventist experience with E.G. White and V.G. Hatta. It reminds me of the space shuttle, his illustration that I gave you. They can't take you off to heaven, but they can boost you up so that you can complete the journey. Then it says Moses told you in Deuteronomy 32 that he will publish the name of the Lord. This is referring to the prophet like unto Moses. This is referring to the doctrine as declared by the mustard seed. Thus, wise do we see that David's Lord leaves Zion with the rod in his hand so that he can bring invitation, not now to the five brethren, but to the rest of the hordes of the seeds of Abraham, so that they can gain inclusion into his house. The message is vested in the authority of the Son of David. When he leaves Zion, probation closes for Zion. They have refused to hear Moses and the prophets. So now he redirects his ministry. When the Bible sets the proverb up and describes Lazarus reclining in the bosom of Abraham, it shows you a level of intimacy that exists between Abraham and the redeemed. And by the way, I forgot to announce the title of my study. Let's call it The Bosom of Abraham's Love. That bosom represents the sure mercies of David, the grace and the love that the world is going to receive when they come into his embrace. It never suspected that there could be so much divine love channeled from heaven through the house of Abraham, the son of David, through the world. But yet we read, didn't we? We read about the sure mercies of David. In fact, this is what the rich man was crying out for, wasn't it? He was crying out for mercy. He didn't have mercy because he wasn't in the bosom of Abraham. He was not receiving Abraham's love. So those that want to be included, there's only one way that they can receive that grace and that mercy. And that's by hearing Moses and the prophets. Moses is the one that publishes the identity. Don't think that you're going to go to an expert in archaeology or linguistics. Don't think that you're going to be able to find somebody that can peer back through time and decipher the language as it was taught, proclaimed, and spoken 3,500 years ago. God has made it easy for you. He has extended to you mercy. He's made it simple for you. We seem to have the impression that we serve a God that is aloof and abstract and expects us at the end of the day to figure Him out even though He's hid Himself from us. No, this is a day of mercy. In fact, we should reorient ourselves as far as the judgment, because the judgment is going to reach out and grace the entire planet with love and mercy. This is the sure mercies of David. So the people outside of the house, they have to hear David. That sounds like a simple statement. It sounds like a statement that seems to be unnecessary. But as the Lord opens up to you the struggles that exist within your life, you more and more have to come to the conclusion that you have to walk closely in alignment with the truth as declared through the mustard seed. That means that your hope and your joy is not vested in your family. It's not vested in your friends. Not even vested in the church members that you've grown fond with in Zion. If you're going to receive salvation, you have to hear the Lord raised up appeal that is going to be broadcast to you. And sometimes that means it's going to be an exclusion to what you've come to expect. So when I say you have to hear David, I'm not just being redundant. I'm telling you that the way in which you relate, the choices that you make, have to envelop around and focus on the truth for this hour. Your brethren that are in the faith need you and need your participation. They need it even more so than does your family or your friends. So when we read in John chapter 13, we get a clear insight of what it means by being contained in the bosom of Abraham. In fact, before I even read John, take your bookmark, keep it there in John 13. Let me direct your attention to Matthew chapter 12, verse 46. While he yet talked to the people, this is Jesus is referring to, behold, his mother and his brother stood without, desiring to speak with him. Then one said unto him, behold, thy mother and thy brethren stand without, desiring to speak with thee. If you could just recapture in your mind the events that are being described here, just by the words. Don't consider this to be just a string of words. This is a real life event. Somebody interrupted the Lord in his studies because he thought that he would show favor to his family. His cousin, maybe not. Maybe an uncle, he would have ignored it. But his mother, well, I know that, see, he's going to recognize and thank me for giving him this information, this slip, this note that's interrupting my sermon. He's going to rejoice because I told him that his mother's there. The Lord showed the standard of discipleship. He said, verse 48, who is my mother and who are my brothers? And he stretched forth his hands towards his disciples and said, behold my mother and my brethren. For whosoever shall do the will of my Father, think of John 6 when you read that. Everyone that seeth the Son and believeth on Him shall have everlasting life, and I will raise him up in the last day. It says, this is the will of the Father that sent me. For whosoever shall do the will of my Father which is in heaven, the same is my brother, my sister, and my mother. So you're not just involved in a social gathering. This is a little bit more than a clique that you may have become accustomed to while you circulated amongst the video, or even the Seventh-day Adventist Church, or whatever church you've been. This is a new family. That means that when somebody in the family wants to know what you're doing, then it's their business. The only reason why they are asking is because they're more closely connected to you. They're drawn towards your bosom, so to speak. And for you to close your arms and shut them out means that you have come to a point in your spiritual growth whereby you need to more fully understand what your calling as a disciple is. John 13, verse 35. And Jesus said unto them, A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another, as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. Didn't say you have to love everybody. These are the disciples. This is a new commandment. In fact, it's a new reality that your love one for another supersedes your love for all others. That ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have loved one to another. Men are going to recognize that just as the man who interrupted the Lord's sermon recognized that the Lord's love was different than what he anticipated. The Lord was more concerned with elevating and teaching his disciples than it was circulating himself amongst his family. If your family members are not going to walk in the truth and in the light, and hopefully if you have little ones, they'll be able to come in under your authority. But if they're going to not walk in the light, then you've got to come face to face with the cold, hard reality that the Lord is going to give you joy in other ways. And that it's wrong to lock them into your bosom and exclude your brother. So how can you love? We talk about love, and that's like a lot of other things that we speak of when we open the Bible. It reduces itself to a cliche. So let's deal with the realities of love. I've known my wife for 30 years. We've been married for 29 years. And truly, I could tell her that I loved her for 30 years. But if I stepped overboard and got ridiculous with the thing and said I loved you for 40 years, then she would recognize me as a phony and my love wouldn't mean anything. Why? I haven't known her for 40 years. When the Lord speaks of love one for another, that means that you begin to know each other. You begin to see each other's quirks in their personality. Television programs have made millions of dollars out of comedies which show people as friends associating with quirky people that do things that are unexpected. The same with us. We all have our own personality signatures. And you cannot draw closer to those people unless they begin to know who you are. Wouldn't it be terrible if you married somebody and you found out after 5 years that her picture was in the post office and they were wanted for bank robberies and whatnot? You'd say to yourself, I didn't even know you were like that. When people who love each other are apart from each other, they automatically begin to miss each other and become concerned with each other so that the questions may seem to be more probing. But you're dealing with a growth factor. You're dealing with a people that have learned more and more to know you and to love you. But you think it's because they want to criticize you. And therefore, if you get the wrong perspective, you put up a barrier. You cross your arms so that nobody can come into your embrace and into your bosom. Therefore, if the brother on an occasion had violated what we know to be divine law, we're all Sabbath keepers. If the brother had done so and gone to Disneyland with his family in violation of the Sabbath laws, let's think about that for an example. I don't know whether it's true or not, you see. But let's suppose that it is true. Then why is it that you want to hide that quality of yourself from your family? By doing that, you are diminishing your closeness. You're creating a great gulf betwixt. What I'm trying to deal with now is the theory of the problem without passing judgment one way or the other because I don't know the facts. But I do know that if you violated the Sabbath, you have to come to grips with the reality that Christ is going to hear about it. So why shouldn't you? the devil is going to bring it up as an impeachment of your character. And it's going to be an embarrassment to the Lord. The least of your problems, therefore, is the embarrassment that you suffer amongst each other. We can no longer hide ourselves from each other. We are a family. There's something very special about being a sin overcomer. But before even I discuss that, we're reading in Genesis chapter 18, remember? And the Lord was about ready to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. That means some people were going to have their days interrupted in a very, very unpleasant way. The Lord discussed it with Abraham. Then Abraham began to negotiate with the Lord. And they resolved on the number 10. The Lord respected that and Abraham respected that. If you could find 10, then you preserve the city. I don't know. The Lord came back and found how many? 4? So instead of preserving the city, he took the 4 out. But I like how the conversation continues in verse 21. Genesis 18, verse 20. And the Lord said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now. So why is he going to go down? Because of their sins. And see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me. And if not, I will know. The Lord was told about the sins of Sodom. He wasn't a first-hand witness. Which shows you, by the way, that this is not God the Father you're talking about. Because God the Father, the Lord, the Bible says, sees even the sparrow that falls. But Christ had to come down and see if Sodom was as bad as he's been told. Somebody's been reporting on Sodom to Christ. Because you don't see the Lord doesn't mean that he doesn't have eyes and ears to check your activity and to report it. And if you've made a mistake, the devil's going to rub it in your face. That's better than, because you see what happens is, if you go out to a place in the world, over here it would be Kennywood. Nobody, I hope, has ever gone to Kennywood on the Sabbath. You go there, you go some of those dangerous rides, the devil's going to say, he's on my turf. He's violating your Sabbath. Let me just disrail this train and make his day unpleasant. And the Lord is going to say, no, you can't do that. That's my servant. He abides by my righteousness. But look at him. He's here on the Sabbath. So, automatically, you put the Lord on the spot. Well, I know how we can resolve this. He's here on the Sabbath. I'll expose that before the brethren so that he can pay the penalty of embarrassment. And that's the price, the recompense that he'll pay. That's an easy price to pay, isn't it? Isn't that generous and fair? But beyond that, it gives you a perfect opportunity to teach the brethren about the child conversion experience. Stand before them and let them see how well you turn the other cheek as they're slapping you back and forth, verbally. Let them see your meekness. Then they'll get to know you even a little bit better. That's much better than closing yourself up and refusing their participation in your life. I can envision the Father as he looks down on earth. I can just envision him asking the Lord, how can he increase his inner circle? Don't think I'm upset with you, Jesus, Christ, but I'd like a bigger family. When I sit at the welcome table, I want 12 other seats there. Can you find me somebody in the universe, not just in Pittsburgh, not in Washington, D.C., not in the United States, not in Canada, but somebody in the universe that has distinguished themselves so that they've overcome sin and can now give glory to me for the path that I laid out for them for their salvation. Can you find me somebody? Gabriel comes in and says, well, there's some people in this quadrant. No, they don't qualify. They've never committed sin. there are some people, let's open up the Bible here now. I mean, look at these people that have lived the life of righteousness. But they haven't identified me. Their knowledge of me has been hidden. Therefore, they haven't been tested so that they can announce to the universe that they love my righteousness. Jesus will stand up and say, I was there. I went down and I died for yes, and that was a great feat. But you've never sinned. You've never gotten victory over sin. You've never paid the price of legitimate accusations against you and stood firm, whereby you had to fight to protect your own reputation or just merely acknowledge that you were wrong. And of course, Christ has never sinned, therefore he doesn't qualify. The only ones that meet that qualification are those disciples who undergo the child conversion experience. They are the only ones. This is why they're included in the family of God. This is why Christ is the same. He that does the will of the Father, the same as my mother, my brother, and my sister. We have a special calling and a high calling. And if you don't like the process of inspection from your brother, then you have one solution. You can walk more circumspectly. But the thing is not to isolate yourself from your brother. Continue to grow in each other, with each other, in love. This is disciple love. And really, what are you fearful of? I mean, there are people in the world who don't even profess to be Christians that on a day-to-day basis are expected to pour out their souls to human beings they confide in. Some people pay $200, $300 an hour to sit in front of a psychologist and tell them all of their shortcomings. You get in trouble with the law, your lawyer's going to want to know the whole deal. Doctor, just had a doctor's visit. It was this past week. And I say doctor, he's a naturopath that has graduated and has now has a doctor's license. So when I visit him, every 2 months, whatnot, he goes over all of my blood reports and whatnot. We stumbled on a question that we never stumbled on before. I brought up the question of male menopause. My wife was saying, why are you bringing this up now? You know what I'm saying? So then my doctor started asking me questions. Well, you know, are you responding to your wife like you used to? Then he made a joke. Doctors got jokes. He said, maybe I should be asking your wife. You see what I'm saying? Maybe I should be asking your wife. I said, well, I described to him the problems that I was having. I wish I could report to you that they were all, you know, the way it was when I was 25, 26. My sons are sitting there. They don't want to hear this. You see what I'm saying? Then he said, well, why haven't you told me? I said, well, the thing is personal. He expected me to open up to him. How can I have a closer relationship with my doctor than I can have with my own eternal family? Let us no longer shut each other off. There are going to be those who have incorrectly made assumptions about you, and there are going to be others that have made correct assumptions about you. Either way, they are deserving of your love. And those things that they uncover that are unsavory, consider that a psychotherapeutic session. A session with your doctor to bring about healing. And then that way, we can exhibit disciple love. So having said that, bring the study to a close.